Hello, good morning, good afternoon. Welcome to the front page from the Racing Post. I am your host, Tom Kerr, and on today's show, we'll be discussing the biggest stories from the last 7 days, including a drugs case that has sent reverberations through the sport, the conclusion of the Racing League and questions about its future. The latest on affordability checks as light touch checks are rolled out for the first time, and the latest on the star of Jumps Racing, Constitution Hill. It's a rather grey and gloomy day in London, but brightening up the studio are two of the Racing Post's finest, James Stevens and Chris Cook. Thanks very much for joining us. James, you were behind the, it's the same desk to be honest, but you were behind the host portion of the desk last week. Relieved to be back in the other side? Or
it was nice to see the host didn't pick their own story for 2 weeks in a row, so no pressure on you there, Tom. We were managing Graham Wadering and David Jennings last week, so I feel a bit more at ease this week.
Yeah, it's high octane. G-Rod's debut on the front page, which was
good fun.
Excellent. Yeah,
good
very
fun.
Good, very good, absolutely. And Chris, how are you? How was your weekend?
Yes, good. It's, again, one of those sort of interstitial weekends, isn't it, between sort of the big meetings. We're sort of, I feel like we're working our way into a jump racing territory, and that does instinctively make me cheer up, you know. There's just something residual from 40 years back, you know.
The
you
start thinking the about seasons.
I got to start investing in some horses to follow books and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So are you starting to load up your Cheltenham portfolio?
I haven't yet, but I have friends who are already talking about it. You
were just talking about it before we started rolling, to be honest.
Well, I was looking at the Champion Hurdle market. Yeah, I haven't invested yet, but it's time to start getting serious about that, right?
It is, and we'll be turning to the jumps in full speed in the coming weeks. And we'll have a little bit at the end of today's show, but we're going to start, Chris, with a big story that you were all over last week. A drugs case which has pretty significant ramifications.
It seems so. It's a kind of a depressing story, really. It's a story about punishments being ramped up, and I think the training community being taken somewhat off guard by it. So Ed Dunlop had a horse that ran at Brighton last year, ran second. I think the horse is still a maiden. Tested positive for a small amount of cocaine afterwards. And after the usual sort of exhaustive investigation by Ed himself, but also by the BHA, source remains a mystery. But of course we know that cocaine is around, you know, one can imagine all sorts of, you know, potential scenarios by which a small amount of cocaine could get in a horse. There's only been a couple of precedents in the last 10 years in those cases. It was a sort of fine of £1,000, and then the second time it was £1,500, which was sort of par for the course for a lot of banned substance type cases, you know, in years gone by. I think you could say that perhaps we've become a little bit complacent about those cases, because so often, you know, they investigate, it takes a year, they can't find the source of the substance, whatever it may be. Trainer has to be held responsible at strict liability, and the standard approach has usually been fine them a grand and everybody moves on. And if you were from an outside perspective arguing, you know, look, you're not taking these cases seriously enough, we've got to, you know, protect racehorses from, you know, anything unhealthy that might get into their system. These fines should be bigger. And in the cause of concentrating minds, I could understand that. But what we have now is a system whereby if your horse tests positive for certain drugs which are in the category A list, the really serious list, then you're gateway punishment is a 2-year disqualification. It actually is suspended, but nevertheless, you know, what you're getting is a disqualification order, you know, the old warning off order, people call it, a really emotive punishment to be getting, and no suggestion that, you know, you have to be found in fault, that, you know, you have to be found to have neglected some particular duty. No onus at all on the prosecuting authority to sort of to show that you've done something wrong. Just the bare fact that your horse has tested positive in the absence of special circumstances is going to get you a really whacking ban. And the odd thing, I think this is the first case that's come up before the disciplinary panel since those new penalties came in. The odd thing, as I say, is that in the guidelines, there's no range of penalties like you would normally expect to see in the BHA penalties guidelines, from, you know, the least serious type of case to the most serious type of case. You'd normally get a sort of spread of potential punishments, and the disciplinary panel can choose where this case falls. There's just that one punishment. It's a 2-year disqualification, suspended for 2 years, and you can add a financial penalty if you want. So that caused a certain amount of puzzlement and a feeling that perhaps, you know, something had been missed out when these guidelines were being put together. But Ed Dunlop's solicitor sort of made a very strong case, saying, look, you know, he has done nothing wrong. He's been in the game 30 years, never had a positive test in Britain before. Never been before the disciplinary panel. He'd been up before one time, but was not found in breach. So an exemplary record, really. And again, no suggestion he'd done anything wrong. So they managed to talk the disciplinary panel down to a one-year disqualification order, suspended for 1 year, but the panel said they weren't comfortable with reducing that type of penalty to a different, softer kind of penalty, like maybe a suspension for making entries that was suspended for a period of time, something like that. The solicitor was obviously, you know, really desperately trying to sort of persuade them that a warning off order was just not appropriate in a case like this, and they wouldn't wear it. So I think that the BHA are hopefully going to look back at this and consider whether really these rewritten guidelines are doing what was intended, because it seems an extremely harsh way to approach a case where, as I say,
Have you spoken to the BHA on this? Have they given you any indication that they will revisit this?
Not explicitly. I mean, there's been really nothing from them. You know, as we know from old, they're not the type of body that likes to react immediately. So this is the first time, as I say, that a case like this has come up, so I'm fairly sure that they will look at it. Whether or not they remain obdurate and say, no, look, we like strict liability, this is the way it has to be with drugs and sport.
Yeah, it is difficult, of course, isn't it? I mean, we've been through so many disciplinary cases in the past, so many cases like this with certain evolutions around it, where it's so hard to say with any certainty at all where the source of a positive test might be. And of course, the consequences of that are twofold, because on the one hand, you have instances, which very much appear to be the case here, where there is a there's probably an innocent or certainly a non-fault reason why this happened. But then if you were to be very cynical, you'd say, well, the problem if you don't have that system in place is it gives people a get-out-of-jail card that they can play and therefore potentially talk away something which may actually be more sinister.
I think there ought to be a distinction made between cases of, you know, contamination, certainly, but where there's really no evidence that somebody has actually tried to sort of subvert the sport, you know, introduce something that's actually performance enhancing. I mean, the panel didn't go into this and get any great depth, but on all the available evidence, I don't think the amount of cocaine that was found is going to do anything helpful for this horse. And indeed, she got beat. So, you know, I think where you can't prove anything against the trainer involved, and there's no suggestion that, you know, you're actually trying to gain some illicit advantage thereby, it's very hard to really drop the bomb on someone and give them a disqualification order, which, you know, that's going to be, as he's concerned, a stigma against his name for a very long time. So Ed has responded by introducing random drug testing for staff at his own stable, and he's also chairman of a sort of Newmarket trainers group, and he's urging his fellow Newmarket trainers to do that as well. Mark Johnson has said that this is something he introduced at his yard in 2021, and he thinks quite successfully. He's lost some staff who didn't want to be tested and others who tested positive, apparently. But he's, you know, I think he explicitly said that that was part of the aim of introducing it. He seemed very comfortable about it. I don't think every trainer will feel quite so comfortable, you know, in a situation where we have a staffing crisis, you know, and which has continued for years. You know, people find it's really difficult to get staff. You introduce something like this, you risk making yourself, you know, still less attractive as an employer. And there's the expense. I mean, I don't suppose it comes cheap. And lots of training businesses are already hard-pressed. It's a can of worms.
We went to NARS, the stable staff union, if you like, and we asked them about this, because we did think, this is going to be a can of worms. There are major sort of questions around it from the staff side about whether this is something that they feel comfortable going through. Some of George McGrath, who heads up NARS's quotes, were quite interesting. He said, some of my members will not like testing, but the only reason I can think of why you would object to it is because you're afraid of being caught.
I mean, I was shocked by how glib that is. Because as he must be aware, you know, there's a range of concerns that his members may have on hearing that, you know, random drug testing at work is a distinct possibility for them in the future.
Aside from anything, if a horse can be contaminated and have a false positive, then so can a person. And you can imagine what that might do to your career and employment prospects if you're then
absolutely
have that hanging over you.
Yeah, I mean, there's a sort of casual rumor going the rounds that somebody attempted to spike somebody else, you know, with malicious intent. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just one of those stories that you get in the racing world, but it's out there, you know. There's a belief that this can happen. I mean, if I was working in a racing yard and this is going to be introduced, you'd want to know all sorts of stuff about specifically what are they testing for? Can they find something else that's not on that list? And if they do, will they report it to my employer? Mm. What will happen to this data? Where will it be kept? Who will it be disclosed to? Can I challenge the finding? How accurate are these tests?
Yeah.
You know, there's a whole list of stuff. And I really wanted George McGrath to say, at the very least, you know, NARS is here for you. You know, there's a case to be made for these tests, but they have to be brought in a controlled way. They have to be proportionate and reasonable. And we will be holding trainers to account in the application of these tests. And if you have any concerns, please do come to us. We have a dedicated team, call this number, something like that. You know, but he was just so sanguine. I mean, the stuff that I read that was in his name in the Racing Post on Friday, I think it was. I mean, it could have been drafted by the NTF, to be honest. I was shocked.
Yes, this is just racing catching up with the rest of the world, he said. I think George may be under some misapprehensions about how widespread drug testing is in workplaces.
Well, yeah, I've certainly never stumbled across it myself.
You know.
Not that I would have anything to worry about, Tom, just to reassure
only
you.
Only those who are guilty need fear the consequences.
Quite right.
James, where do you stand on this one?
Interesting, really interesting case last week. And I think, as you say, the BHA have rolled out these new measures and they've really been given an acid test because suddenly we're in a really interesting predicament. Chris mentioned Mark Johnson's comments. I spoke to Mark on Wednesday, I think, and as you say, it's a concept. I think is a bigger stable that you can certainly see that this will be rolled out a bit more because those big stables just don't want to take the chance, and it's almost a little bit concerning that the sort of motive to test is not so much about we're doing this for the welfare of the horses or the welfare of the staff. It's because in case of an incident like Ed Dunlop, is really what's the real cause behind this, which isn't necessarily the right way to be doing it. I think, personally, you can understand that obviously you're dealing with animals, it's a dangerous job, and any sort of risk of testing, you know, drugs or alcohol, it does need to be clearly looked after. Whether or not drug testing randomly is the right way to go about it, I'm not particularly sure. And from Ed Dunlop at the start, I mean, we're in an interesting perspective for him for the next year because he's got the whole year worrying about his whole staff, his staff base. The relationship between the staff members is probably going to be a little bit awkward. There's a whole lot of pressure. And really, because of a staff member or indeed a cause which we still don't know what it is. So
underpinning everything, you do have that situation that one of the country's foremost trainers with a previously exemplary disciplinary record now does have that sword hanging over him for the next year, knowing that a second strike will mean the imposition of the suspension.
Yeah, and exactly. And I mean, as you said, I mean, staffing is such a huge problem within racing. I mean, working in a racing yard is not the most attractive job you can look at on a website and go, that's definitely what I want to do. It's usually geared by people's passion for horses or their love of racing or aspirations to go towards it. The more barriers you put in and the more reasons you say this is going to be a sort of reason why you shouldn't do it, it's going to make that problem a lot harder, and this is definitely going to be a cause, because for all of George's comments there about, oh well, if you've got nothing to hide, the idea of being tested, it's a real turn-off for a lot of people, and it's another barrier for racing staffing problems.
Okay, we're going to leave that one there. We're going to stick with you, James, though, because you were glued last week to the conclusion of racing's biggest multi-leg team event, the Racing League.
I think glued is the wrong word. I follow Wales and I work in the West, so I should be on a weekend celebrate party for Wales and the West winning the third Racing League.
They've been dancing in the streets of Cardiff, haven't they?
Yes, yeah. Well, obviously, Bristol and Cardiff have always been unified as a region. And that's one of the areas why the Racing League perhaps hasn't been as popular as others said. This is the team concept, which has been around for 3 years now, which perhaps hasn't had...
I think this is the fourth year.
Who can forget? And it's just not quite the same selling point that it was hoped to have. It was sort of brought in with his big intentions of bringing about a new way of looking at horse racing, a team event, which we hadn't previously done. But for all that its backers and, funny enough, the people who are part of it seem to support it, the overarching feeling from social media, from people I speak to at the races, within Racing Post walls, is it hasn't quite had the same success. So whether or not it has a bright future, we don't know. In June, Deputy Industry Editor Pete Scargill reported that the debt the parent company had increased to nearly £5 million.
Yikes.
So the balance sheet is not particularly good. It still gets ITV coverage. The crowds are said to be pretty good. But how bright a future it has, we don't particularly know.
Mm. Someone who certainly enjoyed it was Safi Osborne, and it's Jamie Osborne. Safi had was a top rider, I think, for the third year in a row. And there were some scenes, I think, at the conclusion.
Yeah.
If people have seen the footage on social media, the sort of a Queen tribute band sparking up as the sort of some chaotic interviews. I did wonder what was on the other side of the camera, and whether this triumphant scene was being watched by hundreds of jubilant Wales and the West fans, or possibly not. I don't know.
I'm not sure. Well, it's interesting to see Jamie Osborne appeared on Nick Luck's podcast on Friday, and a bit of debate about what the future should be. And Jamie Osborne has been one of the main supporters of this. I mean, not everyone has bought, all the trainers have bought into the idea of the Racing League. There was a conversation about trainers almost going and running horses in racing to accumulate points. So running in races where they may not necessarily feel they're going to win it, but they could get points towards their team. Now, that as a concept is a very strange one for not just for punters, but for owners to say, right, we're going to run here. I mean, running for prize money has been around for years and years, but to do it for a point towards a team which you probably don't have that much of an affiliation with is a strange one. I mean, the teams, we touched on it there, they're not known areas, you know. I don't think, I've never heard anyone say, where are you from? The East, you know. It just doesn't quite work. And I also think that these regions that they've clubbed together with sort of trainers from other parts of the country representing them, it doesn't quite work. And for people who care a lot about their regional pride or national pride, it's not going to sit well with them. And I think that's clear. And the other sort of element which is interesting is the time of year. It's coming in the middle of York. It's coming in the middle of Goodwood. We've got this jockeys rule, which was brought in through COVID, where they can only ride at one meeting a day. So the star names aren't appearing. They're at those big meetings as they should be. So there's lots of little things to unpick about it. How bright the future is, again, we don't know. Whether there's going to be changes next year, I wouldn't be surprised.
We'll see. Chris, you're a passionate fan, of course, and you were there for the opening leg Yarmouth.
Not really by design. I did just happen to be in Yarmouth at the time.
So I had a good authority. You were beladen with racing
across
league
the country,
merch.
Yes, yeah. Waving the wee flags. Of course. I mean, I'm always up for a novelty event and something a bit different. It does slightly feel that the Racing League has had a good few chances and it's settled down to being what it is now. The scope for it to get better or much more impressive commercially or in terms of its popularity, it must be very limited, I would think. So I don't have great hopes for it. I do feel there might have been scope to do better if they'd really committed to the whole regional thing. But you've got jockeys, you know, like Nicola Curry rides for the London team, for example. I mean, how does that work? And there's poor Scotland needing every bit of help it can get.
Where did Scotland come?
I think we were fifth, really, out of six.
We'll take it.
That's
we'll
where we were that. In the table most of the time when I looked
compared
at it.
Compared to the Euros, it's pretty good.
Right, a huge success. Maybe they got welcomed home off the plane.
Yes. couldn't make it, sadly.
I mean, and again, if you're going to commit to it as a fan, you want to think that they got some sort of chance, and you kind of knew going into the Scottish team weren't going to perform because they haven't in the past, and they don't even provide two runners per race, which is the sort of absolute baseline.
Yeah, some of the races not filling this year, crazy.
If you don't have two runners in every race, you've got no chance. You've basically given up. Like I say, I feel like it could have done better as a concept, but it hasn't, and therefore it's probably on the way out, isn't it? Eventually, apparently it's been renewed for next year.
It's it may be, who knows the future here, I should stress, we don't know, but it's in the way in to America.
Yeah.
The National Thoroughbred League is going to be launching, James, isn't it?
Yeah, I've already picked my team out. I think I'm Nashville Dreams myself.
Yeah. one of them's called like the Delaware Degens, as yeah. in Degenerates, which is... They love okay. degenerates.
And, yeah. yeah. But one of the interesting articles I read is that Lamar Jackson is going to be the sort of team captain of one of them. Now, he has got yeah. a huge pull in America.
Yeah.
Absolutely massive. And
he's got quite a big pull. Without
bigger than Matt Chapman?
Well, exactly. I mean, if someone said to me, right, you've been critical of a racing league, what would you do? I would get rid of a regional or do it properly, or just have a team captain and base them around right. the team captain. You say you had Harry Redknapp had a team,
yeah.
you know, Harry's boys, and he got to draft in his jockeys and stuff. It would be more interesting, and you'd at least yeah. go, oh, well, you know, I'd like to see Redknapp win or whoever else.
Driving into Wolves, he's on the
yeah,
phone.
Yeah, you know, he's sort
last
of
last minute call with Jim Goldie, yeah, trying to get a
trying
new,
to get, yeah. seeing if Nika Kranjčar has ever had any riding experience or something like that. I mean, look, the Americans, it'd be interesting how the Americans do it. I mean, I hate to say it, but the sort of gimmicky events seem to go down
they
a bit more there.
They are better at it. I think, like, you know, we, you know, for better or worse in this country, we're sort of like acutely aware of how embarrassing things are.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
the Racing League, I think, to the British sensibility, is like, well, this is quite
yeah.
quite cringeworthy. But in America, perhaps, they'll throw themselves into it.
Yeah.
And maybe they'll pull off the razzmatazz required to sort of get people
I've
going.
Watched sport in America, and I've obviously watched sport in Britain, and I feel that our audience here can sniff out anything that's not really authentic. I mean, when the Olympics is yeah. on and it's someone's, even if it's a sport you don't really care about, the fact is the Olympics, you want to get behind mm. it, or Wimbledon or something like that. And anything that doesn't quite feel right and it's a little bit saturated, we get through. And the final sort of comment I'd make is that the project has had a lot of defence about prize money, and people have said, well, the prize money is great, so that should be almost a licence to carry on. My comment back at that, which I don't think I've read or seen enough of, is that the prize money is good, but it's only good because the rest of the sport is in such a poor state at the minute. And mm. actually, those levels of prize money is what the sport should be aspiring for in all meetings, not just ones that get that level.
Well, it's probably worth pointing out that if that prize money is sustainable on the basis that you have good field sizes,
yeah.
increased betting turnover, and some TV coverage,
mm.
you know, is that replicable? Is that replicable?
No.
Is that format replicable without relying? I mean, I don't really see what the team element necessarily
no.
adds. Obviously, it got the ITV coverage, which is something. So
yeah.
Anyways, we'll leave it there. We could talk about the Racing League all night, all day, whatever, for weeks potentially. We're going to be back in 1 second after a quick commercial break. Welcome back. We're now going to turn to a subject that we've spoken about very often on this show, which is affordability checks, because last week saw the launch of what are called light touch financial checks. These are the first official checks to be launched following the government's white paper, which was published in April of last year now. The light touch checks are theoretically supposed to take place in the background, i.e. punters won't notice them. They're triggered at net deposits of £500 in 30 days. That sum will reduce to £150 in February of next year. And what bookmakers will be looking for are signs of what are described as financial vulnerability, such as county court judgments or bankruptcies. Gents, I guess what's interesting here is just how these checks will be interpreted, because I did some research on this. There's about 4 million people in the UK that have a CCJ. CCJs can be brought for any level of debt. It doesn't require a large debt. So you could get one, for example, for having an unpaid parking ticket. But also, there's plenty of instances where people incur them because they're not actually aware of what's happened, i.e. a bill has been sent to an old address or something, and they simply don't become aware of it until it's too late. Then it's on your record for 6 years. The Gambling Commission says how these checks should be interpreted is for the bookmakers to determine on a case-by-case basis, and they say there should be a proportionate response. An unpaid parking ticket should not be treated the same as a bankruptcy. But of course, all of that requires the bookmakers to feel confident enough that their decisions will not be second-guessed retrospectively by the Gambling Commission. I think everything that I've seen so far suggests that that's not the case, and that the bookmakers, rather than take a risk, will take a more cautious approach. So that if you have a CCJ, they're probably just going to say, oh, do you know what? We've got hundreds of thousands of customers. We've got businesses around the world. Why take a risk? Shut it down. That's what I think is the concern that will happen, and therefore the consequences for those who might have a CCJ for a minor issue on their record could be more profound. We'll only find out in due course whether that is the case, and of course we'll only find out when individuals who have been affected sort of put their hands up and say, hold on, this is what's happened to me. Certainly encourage people who have had that negative experiences to get in touch with us. We'll put details in the description. I thought one of the really interesting things, though, that went with this story last week was we spoke to Andrew Black about it, the founder, co-founder of Betfair. Andrew's been an outspoken sort of defender of the right to bet. He's an outspoken defender of the sort of civil liberties argument around this. And he warned about the potential outcome, the potential damage for racing and for punters. But what I thought was truly extraordinary and is very relevant with reference to that, the fact that we need bookmakers to show restraint and proportionality here, is Andrew said that he's been rung up many times, even by Betfair, where, he says, in the understatement of the year, they know who I am. He said, I've had several calls, and it's quite annoying, ringing me up, telling me how much I was gambling, as if I didn't know, quoting sums at me to try and discourage me from betting in line with what they feel they have to do, as they're in fear of being fined. When Betfair was sold, Andrew Black cashed in £97.5 million. So they should have a decent idea of his financial situation. But I mean, I know this is just classic administrative nonsense that he hits a trigger and nobody bothers to go, do you know what, that's the ex-founder, is the founder. But Chris, I mean, if Andrew Black's getting it, it doesn't hold up much hope for the rest of us, does it?
It's really worrying. You'd like to see the transcript of that conversation that he had with the Betfair operator, wouldn't he?
You know? Yes, yeah. I mean, if there's ever a case for saying, do you know who I am, that's got to be it, doesn't it? Yeah.
Andrew, you've done in £5,000 opposing City of Troy in the Eclipse. What were you thinking, man? Have you still got any left?
You okay for this?
I mean, you know, you make more than interest that day, probably. Mm. It's very worrying because, as you say, it just feels like the sport is becoming less and less attractive to bookmakers. You know, and in the long run, that is a real, real issue. And this subject of affordability and the problems it's causing for bookmakers has been dragging on for so long, and we still don't have clarity about what the future will hold or about exactly what they should be doing. I'm afraid, as you say, there's every risk that they're just going to sort of tighten up on the poor punter, and we'll have, you know, even more problems than ever before in getting a good bet on and getting a bet on at all and just obtaining the right to bet. So it's a pretty grim future, and I worry that, you know, nobody's riding to our rescue here. You know, we've got a government that seems prepared to risk wild unpopularity with a potential ban on smoking outdoors. You know, if that's the way they're thinking, are they going to be persuaded to rein in the Gambling Commission to protect horse racing?
One would imagine a government with instincts in that vein is going to go the opposite direction and tighten up further.
I'm afraid that is the fear. There's a lot to worry about, but then again, you know, as a committed fan of horse racing, you're sort of left in the position where you're a bit nowhere, and you just got to sort of sit and let time pass and let them get on with it and see what disaster unfolds.
What a manifesto.
And I mean, you know, in the meantime, nothing is happening to us, you know, and the more sort of intrusive checks, they're not a live test that's being
so
done.
So they're being
now.
Piloted. We've got a 6-month pilot where they're checking to see if the solution they identified to make them frictionless, which is to use credit references agencies, will work. I think it's good that they're piloting this. It's good that they're testing it. And it's good that they've identified something which is nominally, at least, going to be frictionless, albeit they're only targeting frictionless for 4 and 5 punters. But there's very little clarity, again, on how they're going to interpret these findings. If it turns out that it doesn't work for 4 out of 5 punters, what will happen then? Will the situation improve? I think it's fair to say the odds of that happening are pretty slim. It's probably the alternative to this is a continuation of the current system with his incredible levels of opacity and very intrusive manual checks. So, yeah, it is a difficult situation, I think. And I think, you know, one of the real concerns for punters, for racing, is just the uncertainty it brings and the lack of any recourse. You know, you sort of get this computer says no moment, and I suppose if you're Andrew Black, he's probably got one or two people at Betfair he can call up and say, guys, seriously. But for the ordinary person, computer says no, you're basically done. You
know? Yeah, there's a couple of things here. I thought when I read this story, there's almost a sense of irony because the bookmakers, this has now been brought in, and bookmakers here have a choice where they go, right, we've got this customer, as you say, who's had sort of one of these checks, what should we do? And bookmakers have been sensed with a gamble here. Do they try and keep customers open and keep these accounts going and add some sort of restrictions or whatnot? Or do they just close the account and eliminate any risks? Now, given the potential for fines, it's quite a straightforward decision, isn't it? Do we keep someone open or do we make sure we don't get any sort of fine? Because no bookmaker will want to be the first under the new sort of regulations which would come in. So I think they're going to treat it with ridiculous amount of caution. So it could be that ordinary punters who have had, as you say, an unpaid parking fine are not serious sort of judgments who may have initially read the coverage and thought, well, okay, well, I'm not going to be affected by that. Suddenly people may be waking up realizing, actually, wait a sec, I'm falling under this category. So a lot more people may not be aware that they were going to be getting a light touch check and whatnot, and they may now. Now, I mean, clearly we know what's going to happen. We've had a 250 million hit for racing estimated. How that changes and what the reality is, I don't know, but that's the estimate, and that's a huge, huge hit to a sport which really needs that sort of money rather than have it taken away. And as Sean Trivis in the HBF said, another reminder, there's every indication it will drive more people to the black market, which has another huge effect, not just on racing's funding, but also what the whole point of this regulation is to try and help and promote safer gambling. Well, it's actually going to drive it the other way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, we'll leave that story there. We'll no doubt be revisiting in the weeks to come as it becomes clearer how these new checks have been implemented. We're going to finish up this week with a story about Constitution Hill. The Racing Post has a new Lambourne correspondent, Liam Head, who's taken up the role officially first day yesterday. And he, along with our correspondents in Newmarket, the North, in France, in Ireland, ensure that we've got the...
You're forgetting one.
West Country, West Country. I am so sorry. I am so sorry. How could I forget the West Country correspondent when he sat right beside me? Yes, collectively, you ensure that we have the inside scoop of what's happening in racing. And Liam will be reporting from on the ground in one of the world's great training centres. He got started early, which is the way we like it. He went along to Seven Barrows last week to catch up with Nicky Henderson and the village's most famous equine inhabitant, Constitution Hill. Constitution Hill, who we of course only saw once last season, very disappointingly, has a new box at Seven Barrows. Apparently has his own grass-covered area and a window overlooking the gallops. Which we hope will assist with his recent problems. Henderson was in pretty jubilant form, or positive form, anyways, I think it's fair to say. He's looking for his stable star to have a racecourse gallop for his expected return to fighting fifth, and then following the same route as the 2022-23 season with the Christmas hurdle, champion hurdle, and entry hurdle under consideration.
Not fences, then.
No, apparently not.
I guess he never really fancied that, the trainer, did he? But
no, it doesn't sound like anyone other than all the sports fans fancied it, unfortunately. So.
But yeah, as you say, just getting him back in the, at the races is a plus. And then you've got to wonder about, you know, what sort of horse we're going to see after the experience that he's had, you know, a very unfortunate one. You know, after that kind of surgery, can we just rely on him being the old Constitution Hill? He's probably going to win, isn't he, the Fighting Fifth? I mean, because as DJ was highlighting in the paper at the weekend, we're not chock full of top-class two-mile hurdlers in Britain. You know, the challengers are all going to come from Ireland.
Yeah.
So he probably is going to get a pretty smooth run.
You were saying before we started filming, absolutely right. Like, they've got to take him on. I mean, you know, Constitution Hill's had some serious health problems, and it would be fairly unusual for a horse to return to its previous peak after problems like that. If there's ever a time to take him on, it's surely this season.
Definitely, yes. If you and yeah, why not, in that sort of swashbuckling spirit of competition? His next race is going to draw an awful lot of eyes for that very reason. Mm. You know, that's when we'll find out what kind of horse we can expect. But I mean, so as I say, I was looking at the Champion Hurdle market on the way in here, and I was a bit surprised to see he's 2-1. I mean, he's only a point shorter than Lossiemouth.
Yeah.
And given what they've both done at the races, I mean, Lossiemouth full of potential. I'm always ready to get excited about a horse with potential who can do better. But the value is surely all with that 2-1. When was the last time he started at that kind of price?
I think maybe the point.
Do you take 2-1 for a race in March?
Well, no, I would certainly not. It's one of those prices, isn't it, where you look at him now and go 2-1, well, that's way too short given what he's gone through. But then you can also look at the same way and go, well, he's miles better than us. So you can really sit on the fence a bit, which is exactly what I'm going to do. interesting to see. I mean, David Jennings compared him to Pele playing in the Saudi League.
It was a good call.
Yes,
got a bit of debate going.
I think it's just another, you know, I like to stay positive, reminder of how dominant Ireland are, and that his competition really depends on how much interest Willie Mullins has in the Fighting Fifth hurdle, the international hurdle races like that, because there aren't many quality two mile. I mean, he said it's possibly the worst bunch of 2 mile hurdlers we've got in Britain, and I'd agree. I mean, the only sort of horse I see, from the horse I get excited about, it's Golden Ace, and I mean, she's a great horse, but she's 33-1 for a Champion Hurdle, which suggests how much potential she has compared to what's over in Ireland. I hope Constitution gets back, and it's great. It's a great, interesting story for the jump season. This super champion who'd lost his way and comes back. Everyone loves a comeback story. And you mentioned at the top his new box. Now, I think ventilation is a very big thing in racing. I remember very well Ben Pauling, who had many years under the Henson rank, was talking about how he designed his yard and all whatnot. He was making sure the absolute priority was ventilation. So I think that's something that Nicky Henson goes away and probably is top of his priority list. He's gone to a lot of effort to make sure Constitution Hill's got the five-star life. So it'd be interesting to see if it pays off.
It's worked well for Ben, hasn't it?
Because he's
on the top of really exposed hill. The wind comes straight from Siberia.
Yeah.
His
great ventilation.
Too
much ventilation. I don't know.
As long as they're rugged up, I think it's fine.
I have to highlight one thing in DJ's column, which was pretty punchy, and he highlighted an exchange on social media, primarily comments by Tony Mullins. He was talking about the suggestion that Constitution Hill would duck and dive all season and barely face any rivals. And Tony Mullins said, Nicky Henderson will prepare him like the expert he is. Why would he look for competition if he can avoid it? I understand why trainers think like that, but...
The only thing I would say on this case is that this is a horse on a recovery mission who's had a very serious... You know, you can... I mean, Nicky Henderson perhaps you can be guilty of missing opportunities because of ground and this and that. With Constitution Hill, I can see if they take it easy, there's a sort of a bit of sense to it. But that mentality is something that's a real problem. And it's why the Cheltenham Festival is currently being reviewed, you know. Too many horses go to the mares when they could go to the Champion Hurdle if they go for this novice chase when they could go for that one. It's a problem deep invested in the game. Mm. And that mentality is scary, isn't it?
There's got to be a mix, hasn't it? There's got to be light and shade. You know, everyone understands that if there's a sort of bit of low-hanging fruit there, then you go for it. But you do also have to love the sport, don't you? If you're a participant in it, you've got to really enjoy those occasions when lots of good horses are taking each other on and we find out who's best, at least on that day. It feels like we've got a little bit too far from that, you know. There has to be a bit more swashbuckling that we mentioned earlier.
I really hope another Mullins isn't thinking that way, because then we're in real trouble.
Yeah.
If he wants to duck and dive, I mean.
Well, exactly. I mean, if Willie's not going to take on Constitution Hill.
Or take on his own, really.
And take on his own.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In fairness, he has in the past shown a willingness to run a few of his own. But then no one else runs.
Well, and you've got all the horses as well. So, yeah, we're going to leave it there. That's the wrap for this week. Only remains to determine what is going on the front page. It'd be very easy to put Constitution Hill on the front page because he's such a superstar. But perhaps doing that shortly after York and before we've really got to say a conclusion of the flat season would have the flat fans up in arms. Probably okay to offend the Racing League fans by not putting it on the front page. And we've had enough of affordability. So I'm going to put the Ed Dunlop story on the front page. It was a very big story over the last few days and has pretty major implications, both for the individuals concerned and the wider sport.
It's going to carry on, isn't it, being a story for a good long while now?
Absolutely is. Yeah. Gents, thank you both so much for joining us in the studio. And to you at home, thank you very much for joining us as well. We'll be back next Monday with more discussion on all the big stories in racing. In the meantime, stay tuned to racingpost.com, the Racing Post newspaper, and all of the shows on our YouTube channel. We'll see you soon.